Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Take Aim, Accuracy in Media's weekly talk show on Blog Talk Radio. AIM is America's original media watchdog, and every week we point out biased coverage and bring you the stories that the mainstream media ignore. We encourage you to visit our website at aim.org and sign up to receive our daily email so you can keep track of what the media are up to. I am Roger Aronoff, a media analyst with AIM, joined today by my co-host Don Irvine, Accuracy in Media's chairman. Good morning, Don. Don, are you there? Sorry about that. We're going to see if we can get Don on the line here quickly. And in the meantime, I know he wanted to talk about an event he went to last week. But in the meantime, let me just refer you to our website where I had an article up yesterday about the status of the healthcare debate. I recommend it to people just to kind of find out what President Obama has been saying and what the status is of this bill and these various versions of the bill, and I think you'll find it very interesting. So that's at aim.org. Don, are you there?
Roger, can you hear me?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
Okay.
So Don last weekend attended the Right Online conference in Pittsburgh. Why don't you tell us about that, Don?
Sure. I just briefly, Right Online, this was their second year holding their conference. They did go to Pittsburgh. They choose the cities based on where the liberal left bloggers of the Netroots Nation go and hold their annual conference. And the primary purpose of Right Online really is to kind of, I think, blunt what Netroots Nation is doing, but also show conservatives and others that there is a viable conservative online presence. And through this administration now particularly, I think that they will. There are people out there that are willing to fight back, and they want to learn more. It was an amazing conference in the sense that the attendance was probably in the neighborhood of 600, 700 people that came out for a two-day event listening to various speakers, whether it's to learn more about card check, healthcare reform, net neutrality. Had some great speakers on Saturday morning, including our guest from last week, Michelle Malkin. And they also had lots of workshops and other things going on Saturday afternoon to help those in attendance learn how to use new media and how to use the tools online to express their voices, to be heard, and to spread the message. So I think it was a great idea, and it's something that apparently is now growing, and I give Americans for Prosperity lots of kudos for pulling this all together. It's not a small feat.
Well, Don, that's a great report. So I want to now introduce our first guest. He is Phil Kirpin, and Phil is the Director of Policy for Americans for Prosperity, who you just mentioned, as well as a contributing editor for National Review Online. He's a Fox Forum contributor on foxnews.com and chairman of the Internet Freedom Coalition. Welcome to Take Aim, Phil.
Great to be with you guys. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you.
Doing great. Phil, let's start off. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Americans for Prosperity and what your role is?
Well, Americans for Prosperity is a national grassroots organization that's dedicated to educating and training regular citizens to become part of the public policy process, federal, state, and local, from the perspective of limited government, lower taxes, fiscal responsibility, and accountability. We've now got about 700,000 members nationally. We have full-time staff in 25 states, and we've been really aggressively taking the lead on the two major national issues we've been working on this year, which are cap and trade and healthcare.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned healthcare. That leads me right into my first question. We know that you are very, very actively engaged in this debate. what is AFP's position on the legislation that is before Congress, and what do you think the prospects are for getting something passed in Congress this year?
Well, we're strongly opposed to both the House bill that's been voted out of three committees, H.R. 3200, and the Senate help bill, to the extent that we can even read the Senate help bill, because they voted it out of committee July 15th, more than a month ago, and they've still not published the final version of the bill as it was voted out of committee, which I think is unprecedented. But based on sort of the chairman's mark that we have seen there and the various amendments, we're strongly opposed to that as well. And you know, I think that the versions of the legislation that have been put forward so far are fairly transparently an attempt to get to a socialized single-payer type Canadian-type system. You know, this idea of a public option was developed by a professor at Yale named Jacob Hacker as a politically possible way to achieve a single-payer outcome. So, that was the deliberate aim. But for that reason, I think that it's been exposed, and my sense is that that will be removed in relatively short order come the fall. And I'm concerned that maybe we've over-focused on that public option aspect, because once that's taken out, I think a lot of the anger and opposition may dissipate, and I think that would be unfortunate. Because in my view, even without that, these bills are disastrous. The centerpiece of the bills, if the public option comes out, becomes the employer mandate that requires every employer to provide health insurance, and the individual mandate that requires every individual to buy health insurance with all kinds of taxpayer subsidies so that lower-income folks, you know, would not be paying with their own money. And it really frightens me, because if the government can mandate by law that everyone buy a particular product, they can also regulate every aspect of that product, what it costs, what it covers, what it excludes, what reimbursement rates it has, and so on and so forth. And I think that we can get to a point where we still have nominally private insurance, but really the government is calling all of the shots. The only difference between that and a directly government-run system is the corrupt deal with these big private insurance companies, where they'll still be able to make huge profits, kind of monopoly profits, because they'll be bought in on the deal and will all be required by law to buy their products. So that's kind of the way I think this will play out in the fall. They'll take public option out. All the industry players will sort of get on board and will strongly support this mandate and subsidy bill. And we're going to have to really fight hard against that, because I think it's every bit as dangerous as the more explicitly government-run versions, and it could be harder to fight against because all the industry guys will get their piece of the pie and they'll be on board.
Well, Phil, this week we heard from some of the House members, like Anthony Weiner, who were saying that if the public option is out, and Nancy Pelosi said something similar, they're going to lose 100 members of the Progressive Caucus or so. Do you buy that, or what do you think the situation is there?
I think it's entertaining to watch, but I think at the end of the day, the very liberal members of the so-called Progressive Caucus will be there for this, because while they would like to go more quickly and have government control right away, I think they'll understand that a mandate subsidy bill is a huge step in the direction that they want to go. And, you know, if your goal is to eventually get to a government-controlled, government-run system, you know, this sort of intermediate step of having very strict regulations requiring everyone, you know, you sort of make a deal with the insurance companies, we'll give you monopoly profits for a while, but you know that if you wanted to snuff them out of business, it becomes pretty easy, because as the costs rise over several years, as these regulations get more and more expensive, then they can build the case to say, come back, see, we really needed that government plan. So I think that ultimately they'll see this as sort of a step towards where they want to be. I'd be very surprised at the end of the day if the so-called progressives really bolt on any piece of legislation, because any way they do this, as long as it's got those mandates and subsidies in there, it's a huge, huge increase in government power. There's a lot more money running through Washington. There's a lot more decision-making running through Washington, and ultimately I think that's what they're after. So I think that this is entertaining. It creates some good dynamics, but I would not count on anyone from the left stopping this thing. I think it's going to have to be opposition from the grassroots and from the right.
And one more question on this. Why we saw that the pharmaceutical industry is planning to spend $150 million in advertisement to promote the Obamacare plan? Why would they be on board?
Well, they made a corrupt deal. They made a corrupt deal with the White House. Basically what they said is, if you don't regulate our prices, and I agree with them on this, I think prescription drug price controls would be a disaster because we get a lot less innovation if they couldn't make back the money of all the expensive R&D and so on. But basically, they made a deal. They said, don't put any price controls on us. Fill in the donut hole in Medicare prescription, in the Medicare prescription drug benefit, because right now there's a benefit up to a certain amount, then it goes away, and then it kicks in again at a higher amount. So that is, that space in between where folks have to buy their own drugs or have other coverage, that's called the donut hole. They said if you don't do prescription drug price controls, fill in the donut hole, we'll agree to support this plan and put a lot of money into it, and we'll sell drugs at half price, name brand drugs at half price inside that donut hole. So essentially, you give us a lot of new business, we'll give you a discount on that business. You leave us alone on price controls, and in exchange, we'll spend, you know, $150 million pushing this plan. And I think they've got, I think they're crazy, frankly, trying to cut a deal like this. They've already been whacked in the House Energy and Commerce Committee. They put in prescription drug price controls as an amendment. And, you know, pharma went nuts. They said, we have a deal. You can't dare do this, all the rest of it. But, you know, they're trying to make a deal with the devil. And I think the I think that even if they're spared on this go-round, even if this deal plays out exactly the way they want it to, it's only a matter of time in a year or two before they come back and say, we can't spend all this money on drugs. We're going to put price controls in. So I think they're being very short-sighted. And, you know, I don't really think that this deal is going to hold. But even if it does hold, whose interest does it really serve to have pharmaceutical companies sort of writing the checks for a government takeover? I mean, they might get some revenue in the short term, but you look any country in the world that has a government-run system, they pay a fraction of the real cost of developing drugs. The whole rest of the world is free-riding on us right now. We're the only place in the world where prices are high enough to cover the research and development costs and all the FDA testing and everything else of developing new drugs. And, you know, the rest of the world, they can pay much lower prices because they're free riding on that. They just pay the cost of producing a pill and maybe a little bit more shipping it, and that's it. But if we start to have a government-run system, I don't think that pharma's deal can hold very long, and that means we're going to lose all that innovation. The whole world is going to.
Very interesting. Last week you were mentioned on MSNBC by Rachel Maddow as part of some right-wing scheme to block health care reform, and she's trying to paint this picture of lobbyists and, you know, big money that's behind what they're calling the AstroTurf movement of people, you know, not a real grassroots movement, but AstroTurf. Why was she talking about you? What did she accuse you of? And would you care to respond to her charges here?
Well, I it's kind of funny because in between segments when she was slamming us for being, you know, evil AstroTurf for the insurance industry and so on, she's running these commercials from AHIP, the American Health Insurance Plans, which is the big health insurance industry trade association, and from pharma, and they're saying, we want a plan. We support reform. So, you know, the big industry groups are all supporting a big government plan. Now, they want the public option out, and in my view, they'll get it out, but at the end of the day, they want that mandate that says we're required by law to buy their product. That's what they want in this debate. So her theory requires believing a conspiracy on the order of the same folks who want this are spending hundreds of millions to support it and stand to make billions if they get the kind of bill they want through are also secretly funding the opposition. Now, I don't think, you know, that's a level of kind of crazy conspiracy thinking that I think people should be able to dismiss out of hand. There's no reason for the insurance industry to support us because I want to kill the exact bill that they want and that they have a good chance of getting. So the accusations make absolutely no sense. They're completely unfounded. And, you know, I think what's going on MSNBC and Nancy Pelosi and others is they're trying to convince Democratic members of Congress that it's politically okay to ignore their voters, to ignore their constituents. They're trying to convince Democrats, don't worry, all these people out there are fake. It's politically safe to vote for this. And I have to hope that these guys have more political sense than to fall for that, because if they do fall for it, I think they're going to have a rude wake-up call on the election trail next year and on Election Day. I mean, I don't understand why anyone would believe that somehow all of this anger and all of the you know, all the events and all the pushback and all the folks showing up and protesting are fake. I find it hard to believe that they're going to convince Democrats of that. But look, if they convince some of them that they can ignore their voters and walk the plank and vote for this right on top of the terrible vote a lot of them made on cap and trade, I think they'll suffer for it at the polls last year. So the question is kind of, I think, what happens in the Senate? Can we hold the Senate? Because I think this has more to do with the House. I think that the senators have much better understanding of sort of the lay of the land, much more nuanced, and they're also much more risk averse. So that I think is ultimately where this will be played out. But I think that the whole manufactured anger thing, which, by the way, the manufactured anger talking point that MSNBC was using was originally written on the Think Progress blog, which is the Soros-funded blog from the Center for American Progress. It was based on a complete fabrication. There was one guy in Connecticut who put something on his website that they claimed was secretly leaked from AFP and FreedomWorks and so on. It wasn't. They made that up. As soon as they put that up, the Democratic National Committee sent it around to everyone they knew. A couple days later, it was in the New York Times. It was in every major newspaper. It was on MSNBC, and the White House was talking about it, and all the major Democratic leaders were talking about it. So to me, they seem to have the anger manufacturing machine going. I think all we're doing is getting folks real information.
Well, that kind of stays on this theme here of, can you compare how well the conservatives are organized in this battle versus how well the left is and how well financed either side is?
Well, the left is massively better financed than we are. I mean, the pharma spending alone of $150 million, I think, dwarfs everything that's going on the right. I can tell you, though, that we're very proud of the fact that we've raised about $10 million for our healthcare effort, and we've raised that money. Not one penny of that $10 million came from a corporate contribution. It's all from individual donors, from patients who are worried about the direction of healthcare in this country. And frankly, this is the most successful project we've ever had for that very reason, that people are concerned and they're willing to contribute to it. And we've done a great, great program. We've got a lot of information out there. We're running, holding events all over the country. But, you know, someone has to hold the events. That doesn't mean the people who show up are fake. They're real people who show up. But this is all, it's pretty expensive. We've been doing some TV ads to try to counter what the left is doing. But frankly, what we've done and what other conservative groups have done is a drop in the bucket. We're getting outspent on TV about 4 or 5 to 1 right now. We're getting outspent on the grassroots by an even wider margin. The left is paying activists who show up at their events and organizers. There are ads all over Craigslist for it. Of course, we don't have enough money to do that, so we don't do that. And frankly, you know, I don't think it's interesting. Barbara Boxer had this comment last week. She said, these don't look like real protesters. They're like well-dressed middle-class people, something like that. That's a paraphrase. But, you know, sometimes middle-class people get angry enough to show up and do something, and the left doesn't have an exclusive franchise on protests. You don't have to be a dirty hippie to be a legitimate protester. Sometimes middle-class people do get angry enough and show up and protest. And, frankly, conservatives wouldn't show up at a protest because you offered them $10. They've got other things to do. They're giving up time at work. They're giving up time with their family. They're making sacrifices in order to show up at these events. The left can organize that way. They do organize that way, and they assume that we do the same thing. But it wouldn't even work if we tried on the right. You couldn't get thousands of people at rallies the way we've been seeing by offering them $10 each, even if we did have the money to do it. And so I think that there's some projection going on. They're just sort of assuming that we do things the same way they do. But the reality is they have much, much more money than we do. They have access to a lot of big foundation money. They have union money. SEIU has been leading this whole charge. They've got access to the industry groups that have basically sold out and want that mandate and subsidy style bill. And so, you know, all the big money's on the other side. That's what makes this sort of so bizarre to listen to this claim that somehow we're fronts for big money. And I am proud of what we've been able to raise because it is, you know, it's dwarfed by the left, yes, but it's very substantial for a group like ours, and especially to do it without corporate money. I'm proud of that, and I'm proud of what we've been doing on this. And I'm not going to run from it or say that we're fake or phony or any of that other stuff.
Well, I tried to attend. I tried to attend Senator Cardin's town hall last week in Hagerstown, and I just didn't get there early enough. There was a huge crowd there trying to get in. But in observation, one of the things that I thought was interesting is that as I looked at the crowd that was lined up to go in, you have hundreds and hundreds of people carrying homemade signs, protesting the president's plan, the Democrats' plan. On the other hand, there were many, not a lot, but quite a few Organizing for America placards running around, and the other people that were associated with that, there were maybe three or four, kind of homemade signs, but the best they could come up with was carrying these little blue placards saying, you know, organizing for America. They didn't seem to actually have any ingenuity to the originality to come and try to do something to support their side. They did look like, you know, they were just lined up and paid or something like that. It's very interesting. Have you seen that type of thing play out in other areas?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think they did not expect anything like what they've seen, and so they're really scrambling to catch up. I think that they've been better organized in some places than others. For instance, the president's town hall thing he did up in New Hampshire, they bussed in almost everyone on their side from Massachusetts, and they all had signs, and they were fairly well organized. But almost every place we've seen our side just kind of dwarf what they've been able to muster, and so I think it's pretty typical what you saw. You know, I'll also point out, there's a great video, if folks, you can find it pretty easily on YouTube. I don't know the exact search terms, but there's this video of that New Hampshire protest. We also have one, actually, AFP did a video of the Cardin event where you are, which is a pretty good one, too. You can find on the AFP Maryland YouTube. But this New Hampshire one was very striking to me because they have all these guys getting off the buses that unions paid for to bring in, you know, pro-Obamacare folks. And then the camera overheard one of them saying, of all the real protesters who were there, one of these guys getting off a bus said, "Oh, there's the Republican rent-a-mob." So some of them clearly believe this stuff, but you know, I think that anyone who's been to one of these events or has really looked at the videos, you know, that people took, not necessarily the ones that were coverage on TV, knows that you know, the left has been able to muster sort of anemic numbers of mostly bust-in folks, of paid folks. And the right, these are real grassroots on the right, and they're big, and they have substantial numbers, and they've got their own signs, as you pointed out.
Let's talk about some other issues that Americans for Prosperity has been working on. You mentioned cap and trade. Now, we know the bill passed the House, and right now it seems kind of stuck in the Senate, and tell us your involvement in that and just kind of frame the issue for us and where it stands politically.
Absolutely. We've been heavily focused on trying to educate people about the costs associated with cap and trade for the past 2 years or so, and the, sort of the centerpiece of that effort is our hot air tour, which is we take a 70-foot-tall hot air balloon around the country. It's emblazoned on the side. Cap and trade means higher taxes, lost jobs, and less freedom. And we do these events where we give folks balloon rides and some food, and they listen to us talk about, you know, what the costs are. We hand out talking points, and we try to generate contacts into U.S. senators. And it's been a very successful program. We're actually on the road today in Bluefield, Virginia. I was this morning, and then this evening we're going to be in Roanoke. So that's been another ongoing project of ours. We've been heavily involved in that. We tried to generate a lot of citizen contacts by telling folks about the House vote and get them engaged and involved on that. The House vote earlier this year, it passed the House 219 to 212. There were 44 Democrats who voted no. There were 8 Republicans who voted yes. But there were a lot of encouraging signs in that vote. 57 of the yes votes came from just 2 states, 32 from California, 25 from New York. 28 state delegations voted no. And in a lot of the states where we've really been focused on recruiting and educating people in anticipation of the Senate fight, we had pretty good results in that House vote. So in Indiana, for instance, where Evan Bayh is up in the air, 3 out of 5 Democrats voted no. In Arkansas, where both senators are up in the air, 2 out of 3 Democrats voted no. Both West Virginia Democrats voted no. The at-large Democrat Earl Pomeroy from North Dakota voted no. Stephanie Herset-Sandlin from South Dakota voted no. So there are a lot of kernels there of hope. And in the Senate right now, it looks like we're in pretty good shape. We've got 4 U.S. senators who said they don't want to have a vote this year. Those are Conrad and Dorgan from North Dakota, Nelson from Nebraska, and Lincoln from Arkansas. We had 9 Democratic senators who wrote a letter saying we won't vote for the bill if Wall Street banks are allowed to make money on the trading portion of it. And that's going to be a big problem because the Wall Street banks have been one of the huge lobbying pushes behind the bill, and people like Chuck Schumer support it, I think, primarily because of that. So that's going to be a big rift for them. And they also had 10 Democratic senators who said we'll only support this if there's a big carbon tariff in the bill. And, you know, the reason they want that, of course, is if there's no carbon tariff in the bill, then we'll just move all of our production jobs overseas and we'll just import the same goods that we would have made in America, and we won't have done anything for global warming, but we'll have lost a lot of American jobs. Even the EPA says that's a likely outcome. The problem with the tariff, of course, is that it's WTO illegal. It would probably start a trade war. It could even start World War III if China retaliated by invading Taiwan, which wouldn't be out of the question if you put a huge tariff on all the Chinese goods. So it's probably not a realistic solution to this problem of jobs moving abroad. The White House is against the tariff. And so that's another potential huge rift, those 10 senators who say it has to be in there versus all of the common sense reasons it would be a bad idea. So they've got a lot of strains. I think that we'll probably beat it in the Senate this year. I'm cautiously optimistic. They might not even be able to move forward and have a vote if it looks like they're going to be embarrassed on it. The only reason I have for caution there and for people not to be too optimistic is 2 days before the House vote, this thing was dead. It was 30 votes short. And the White House took over the whip operation. They sent Rahm Emanuel up to the Hill. President Obama himself had this luau where they were pushing Democrats into a room with him, and he was personally saying, this is a party loyalty issue. I need you on this. It's symbolic. They had Axelrod say publicly, if we can't pass this, we're incapable of governing. They essentially bet the White House on it. They bet the presidency on it, and that's how they got it through. I fear that if they're willing to do that again in the Senate, a lot of these Democrats who have major concerns will eventually fall into line under pressure from the White House. So we're trying to get a lot of people engaged, educated on this, get letters and faxes and calls going into these offices so that if that happens, if, say, a Senator Bayh or a Senator Lincoln gets called into the White House, they'll be able to say to the president will say, I need you, it's a party loyalty vote. They'll be able to say, I'm sorry, I can't do it. I heard from 40,000 of my constituents, and they said, no, I can't be there for you on this one. So we need to keep doing our work, because even though it looks good right now, it could change if the White House really puts pressure on it. We need to be in a good position where they'll be able to say no if that happens.
Okay, I think maybe Obama might be losing some of his clout and
I think, yeah, you're right.
Too much
look.
Political capital on the health care issue, and that might come into play.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Senator John Kerry recently said that if health care takes through the end of the year, then they just won't have time to take up cap and trade. And I think that's sort of signaling exactly what you said, that this health care thing could be such a heavy lift that he can't go back to people and say, I need you on cap and trade. They'll say, what are you kidding me? I just had this health care fight for you. So, yeah, these two issues definitely interrelate in that way.
So we just have a few minutes left with you, Phil, so let's get a touch on a couple more things. The issue of net neutrality, I think that's something that still eludes a lot of people. Just briefly, try to explain a little the issue and who the forces lined up on either side of that and what the implications of it are. I know that's a lot.
This could be a much bigger issue than people realize. And at this Netroots Nation convention, they were saying that after healthcare, this is what the hard left wants their next big push to be. They seem to care even more about this than about cap and trade, if you can believe that. And this is a concept basically to regulate the internet the same way the old phone companies were regulated, that is common carrier style regulation, where the ISPs would just have what they call a big dumb pipe. They wouldn't be able to manage their network. They wouldn't be able to prioritize certain products. Like they couldn't, you know, guarantee that if you want to do telemedicine or teleconferencing or some kind of movie delivery service, they wouldn't be able to do a business arrangement that guarantees that that would have a higher priority traffic than, say, a teenager who's stealing video games or something else around the corner. They want a regulation that says all internet traffic must be treated exactly the same way. It has some basic appeal to it. It sounds like, oh yeah, that's we're for treating everything the same way. But the problem is that the way these networks are designed, there's a huge, huge challenge just to keep up with growing demand, and there needs to be an ability to prioritize traffic, to enter into different types of business relationships where you might have guaranteed bandwidth for something or another that's of a higher priority. And the left has said for a number of years that if the phone and cable companies are allowed to do that, they will do all kinds of mischief. They'll block access to left-wing websites and censor people, and they'll divert your traffic from one site to another and all sorts of things. There's not been a single instance of them ever trying to do this. And in reality, in my view, they can't, because if the cable company tried to do something like that, they'd lose all their business to the phone company and so on. But if government steps in and puts these regulations in place, it will destroy private investment. I mean, these networks cost billions and billions of dollars to build and even to maintain. And if you can't get a return on that investment, because a variety of business practices and even management of your network under some circumstances is now prohibited by law, private investment will dry up, and the hundreds of billions of dollars that we've seen in recent years of private investment in the internet will dry up and disappear. Now, advocates of network neutrality say that's fine. It's infrastructure like a highway, and it ought to be supported by taxpayer dollars and run by the government. It doesn't bother them that this bill will destroy private investment. But I think we need to be very, very frightened of what happens in a world where the government essentially owns the internet, where it's public taxpayer dollars that are going to fund it, and there are bureaucrats making decisions and controlling things and so on. Because unlike in the situation where a private company tried to censor or block access, there would be no competitive check if the government tried to do it, and there are a number of subtle ways that they could do it. And not so subtle ways potentially down the line. So I think this is a huge, huge threat to our ability as conservatives to organize online and to use the internet to get our messages out. I think that if we got to a place where government had control, that could be lost. And there's even more reason to be concerned. This is not directly related to net neutrality, but it tells you where some members of the administration are coming from. Cass Sunstein, the regulatory czar in the White House, had a proposal in his book Nudge where he suggested that we might set up a regime where if somebody sees something on the internet that they think is untrue, they could report it to the government. If the government agrees that it's false, they would send a takedown notice to the website that had listed something that was false. So, I mean, they're already talking about content censorship potentially, and in my view that becomes much, much more easy to do if you've got a system that's taxpayer financed and strictly regulated, which is what this net neutrality fight is about. They dropped legislation just before the recess. It was the Markey Eshoo Bill, H.R. 3458. And that legislation is really quite draconian. I mean, for the past 5 years, we've been saying what they really want to do is put regulations in that say every bit has to be treated the same way, even though that would destroy private investment. They've said that's not really what we're after. We just want to stop mischief by the phone and cable companies. This bill that they dropped makes pretty clear that it's the most extreme version that they're after. It's a very aggressive bill that not only regulates the public internet this way, but every company's private network as well, which I really can't understand the rationale for, but it's a pretty sweeping bill. I think this could be one of the next big, big pushes from the left after healthcare, so something that we're trying to educate people on. Obviously, it's a more difficult issue to explain when you get into, you know, sort of technology regulation, but I think the important thing to understand is that the goal of these regulations, in my view, is to destroy private investment in the internet, make it run like a utility or like a highway as an infrastructure project. And the guy who runs the group that's been the most vocal proponent of this, Robert McChesney, runs the group called Free Press that's really been pushing for this. He's a socialist. I mean, he had an interview with a socialist website recently where he said this is the most important step towards the revolution and all that kind of thing. I guess it's now polite to say that sort of thing in public, but I think it's certainly worth bearing in mind.
Phil, one final brief response. We are a media watchdog group, so just give us a brief grade on how the media covers these issues you've been talking about today. Do we find anything out about these stories that you're telling us about by watching the evening news or MSNBC or, you know, just give us a quick one and then we got to close here.
Well, I think that Fox is terrific, and it's great to have a network that is willing to cover these things from a more fair perspective than some of the other networks. I think that the network guys have been really bad. I think that in particular, they've done a huge disservice to the country when they talk about healthcare by trying to dismiss all of the legitimate concerns that conservatives have by saying that's not in this bill, as if it's not legitimate to predict what the effects of a piece of legislation are. I think it's disingenuous and a huge disservice to the American public.
Okay, well, listen, Phil Kirpin, it's been great having you on here today, and keep up the good work, and thank you so much. And what's your website, just so everyone can go take a look?
Our company website is AmericansForProsperity.org, and my personal website is philkirpin.com.
That's K-E-R-P-E-N. So, okay, thank you.
All right, have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye.
Our next guest is the co-producer and director of a new film that's just out, and that film is called Not Evil, Just Wrong. And the guest today is named Philip McAleer.
Well done.
Okay, thank you. And Philem, this is his fourth documentary, I believe, and before he started making documentaries, he was a correspondent for the Sunday Times in the UK, for the Financial Times in Eastern Europe, for The Economist in Romania and Bulgaria, mm-hmm. and he's written for a number of other newspapers as well, and he's, as I say, done several documentaries, and let's see, I think we'll leave that part there and get into it. Why don't you tell us? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think people might remember our previous documentary, Mind Your Own Business, which really looked at the campaigns by environmentalists to stop mining projects all over the world and damage the lives of vulnerable people and poor people around the planet. You know, and our latest documentary now, Not Evil, Just Wrong, is looking at that in terms of global warming and similar environmentalist claims. You know, we're constantly told the science is settled and we need to, you know, cut back on carbon emissions. But no one's ever really confirmed that the science is settled. And the second thing is, you know, is there an emergency? Is there an urgency? And if, you know, is the cure that's been offered, is it worse than the disease? How is this going to affect Americans and their jobs and their communities during one of the worst recessions in living memory?
And where did the title come from? What is the title?
Well, we look at the environmentalists' first big victory, and some of your listeners may remember that or may know about it. It's that great victory over DDT. When they managed to get DDT banned, you know, which was great for America because, you know, we'd got rid of malaria here and, you know, we had used it and finally eradicated the scourge of malaria from America. But it wasn't great for the developing world. Since DDT was banned, malaria has spiked in the developing world and it's been between about 30 to 50 million deaths because of the lack of DDT. So one of our characters in the documentary is Roy Innes, the chairman of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, a former civil rights leader. And he visits a malaria hospital in Uganda. And, you know, it's full of children dying because malaria attacks, you know, children and pregnant women the most because it attacks those with weakened immune systems. And he comes out of that hospital, that miserable hospital in Uganda, full of children dying of a preventable disease, a disease that is being caused or helped being spread by environmental, you know, emotionalism. And Roy comes out and he says, you know, we've got to do something. So this has to stop, you know. And, you know, we've got to tell these people that what they did is not right. He says, these people are not evil people, but they are wrong. So they're not evil, just wrong. And we need to say that to people. Look, you know, you may have the best intentions, but if you're going to destroy the lives of people in the developing world and then destroy the lives of people in the developed world by this cap-and-trade recession-introducing legislation, then we need to say to you, look, it's not evil, but it is wrong. Let's look at the consequences of your actions.
Philem, this is Don Irvine.
Mm-hmm. Don?
How you doing? Let's talk about global warming. You know,
yes.
AIM has been following, you know, this topic for a number of years,
mm-hmm.
obviously focusing out on the media coverage of the issue. But, you know, in your opinion, you know, is global warming occurring?
Maybe. I think for the last 10 or 15 years, it hasn't been occurring. Certainly, the world temperatures have been decreasing. Whether there's an overall upward trend is still debatable. But I do know it was warmer before. It was much warmer before. Greenland was called Greenland for a reason. They used to grow wine grapes in Yorkshire. You know, there's fossil evidence that it was very, very warmer thousands of years ago, and there was no SUVs and there was no aeroplanes. So it's possible there's global warming, but it's definitely not warmer than the warmest it's ever been. And heat is good for life. Heat is good for trade. Heat is good for people. Coal kills more people than heat. So Is it warmer? Maybe it is. Is that a bad thing? Probably not. And should we destroy the economies of the developed world and the potential of the developing world because of this? Absolutely not.
Well, in the film, Richard Lindzen, the MIT scientist, said that there has been no real warming since 1995. And then we see noted global warming expert Al Gore saying in your film that something like 21 of the hottest years on record have occurred during the last 25 years.
Yes.
How do we know what to believe?
Well, I mean, actually, those figures of NASA have now said, oops, we got it wrong. Those figures that Al Gore quotes aren't right. So now Al Gore and James Hansen, those people are saying, well, it's wrong to, you know, you can't get a trend from any individual years, and it's wrong to take a small snapshot and call it a trend, because when NASA issued their revised figures, it showed a downward trend recently. So they're now saying that's not significant. That's what global warming alarmists do, you know, when the figures back them, they say, oh, it was warm last summer, that means it must be global warming. And when somebody produces figures to say, well, actually, since, you know, it's been actually on a cooling trend, they say, oh, you can't take individual years and make a point of that. The climate's much bigger than that. So they choose the figures to match their ideology, I suppose, or their end. They use them as a means to their end, you know. And as we say in our film, you know, this they need to, you know, they just can't say the science has settled and moved on and move on. This is a very serious matter, and this is very serious consequences for the planet and the people on the planet, and they need to be called to account, and they need to stand up and defend their science.
One of the people you have featured in the film is Patrick Moore, one of the founders of Greenpeace, and he certainly seems to have sort of seen the light, but I noticed there's a new story out yesterday that you're involved with that seems to be going viral today. On the internet about some comments issued by the, we'll call it the post-Patrick Moore Greenpeace about vanishing Arctic ice. Tell us this story.
Oh, well, actually, it's funny. I was home in Ireland there. Actually, I was in the UK as well. And I was watching BBC Hard Talk program, and they were interviewing the head of Greenpeace. And, you know, I thought, oh, my God, BBC interviewing Greenpeace. It'll be a love fest, you know. Tell us how messed up we are and what we can do. And the Greenpeace guy tells them on the BBC. I call most environment correspondents in these mainstream media organizations, I call them nodding dogs, because they just listen to what the environmentalists say and nod gravely. But Stephen Sacker of the BBC turned out to be no nodding dog. And he started questioning Mr. Greenpeace, Mr. Gerd Leopold, on his facts and on his figures. And eventually got Mr. Leopold to admit reluctantly that the Arctic ice is not melting, that the Arctic ice in Greenland will never melt, and that the press release that they say released a week or so ago saying that it was in severe danger of melting, that was misleading. Leopold then says, we're not apologizing for, quote, emotionalizing issues. You know, in other words, I think I know that's English, but let me translate that for your American audience. I think we call that lying, emotionalizing the issues. And no one seemed to notice this, and so I pulled it out and put it on our blog, and we've had hundreds of comments since then, and it's been picked up by Hot Air, it's been picked up by various blogs and the media. Sean Hannity mentioned it on his blog. And now Greenpeace have just seen they've issued a press release to their members saying, we need this to go viral. This is the clarification. You know, it's not quite true, and we need to clarify. We need to get it out there because it's getting a lot of traction. Can you please make this go viral? Which I thought was quite funny. It's called, you know, they accuse the other side of astroturfing, but this is Greenpeace saying to its members, let's make this viral, please. You know, in other words, let's pretend there's a mass movement out there that are fighting back against this mistaken allegations against Greenpeace. So Greenpeace are running scared today. They're misleading. They're emotionalizing of the issues, as the leader said, has been revealed, and they don't like it. As they say in Britain, they don't like it up them.
Amazing. Well, we are certainly known here as global warming skeptics, at least.
No.
As well.
No.
And you know, would often make the point that there is no consensus, as the media like to say, that, you know, that all legitimate scientists agree. But one of the questions that I get asked quite a bit is, well, what is the harm? Just in case Al Gore and these people are right, and reducing the amount of pollution and carbon dioxide into the air.
Yeah.
Isn't it a win-win situation? Even if they're wrong about the global warming, at least we'll end up with a cleaner environment. What do you say to that?
Yeah, it's a win-win situation if you're really wealthy. You know, as we knew this as a question. So in our film, we go and interview and show the life of a family in a lovely town in Vivi, Indiana. He works in a car factory. She looks after the children. He has a great job at the car factory, you know. And we look at, but it's a job that's dependent upon cheap energy. It's a life and a lifestyle and a community that is dependent upon cheap energy. You know, if you live in Connecticut or in Manhattan and you're wealthy and you don't know where electricity comes from except from a light switch, you think, sure, I can pay a bit more and the planet will be better. But if you work in a factory that depends upon cheap energy to produce goods that there's very little profit on, if you increase the costs by 30%, then those people are out of jobs, and those jobs go to China. It's a stimulus bill for China, Al Gore's proposals. It's not a stimulus bill for anybody else. I mean, people and we interview this, and these people in Vivi, Indiana, they've moved into a new house. It's the American dream. They've moved from a trailer to a small house to a bigger house, all on the strength of his job that depends upon cheap energy. And you can check him out on our website, noteviljustwrong.com. But I mean, I think people who think that this won't do any harm, and it's for the greater good anyway, I suppose they're just so wealthy that they don't need to know the difference. I mean, I always say, how do you know you become so wealthy in life that you'll never have to work again? It's not if you've got a Cadillac. It's not if you've got a swimming pool. It's not if you've got a fancy house. It's when your kids come home from college or school and say, Mom, Dad, I've become an environmentalist. Because then you know that you become so far removed about how the world really works and how things are really made that you'll never really have to work hard again. You know, so it's all very well for the people whose kids are environmentalists and who have got the money to pay a bit extra for their electricity bill. You know, it's like their little good deed for the day, but it's got serious consequences for people in the middle of America, and it's got deadly consequences for people in the developing world. These liberals are supposed to care about Africa and ending poverty. How are you going to end poverty if you don't allow them to industrialize? You're going to condemn them to a lifetime of subsistence farming.
Right, and of course it's also going to create a huge sort of UN bureaucracy to oversee this whole thing, which, you know, is going to create these global taxes and redistribution.
Yep.
That
mm-hmm.
could be just a nightmare.
Yeah.
So speaking of the UN, the source that Al Gore and others always use is this IPCC, the
yes.
International Panel on Climate Change. So they are the ones that supposedly put out this data that backs up their case. Well, who are these people? Can we trust the IPCC? And what is your opinion of their data?
Well, you see, much of what's in the IPCC report is not what gets reported, you know. So the IPCC report is rewritten into a summary for policymakers, which is a political document written by politicians influenced by NGOs. So that exaggerates and corrupts what's in the IPCC report. But the IPCC report is written by a lot of environmental scientists and people who aren't meteorologists and people who are not physicists and are not geologists. I mean, if you had a few geologists on the IPCC, they would show you fossil evidence that the Earth was much, much, much warmer before, and it was much, much more fertile before when it was this warm, you know, when there was tropical forests over much of the world because it was so warm and huge growth. I mean, but if you want biodiversity, let the Earth get warmer. Warmth, around the equator, there's lots of biodiversity. Go to Ireland, there's very little because it's cold in the winter. It freezes. You know, as Patrick Moore says, ice is the enemy of life, you know. So, I mean, so this is the film, really. This is the answer to Al Gore and the IPCC, our film, Not Evil, Just Wrong. And we want to get it into people's homes, and we want to get it into people's schools. So we've got a rather unique distribution strategy to arrange that.
You make the case that Al Gore is a hypocrite. How so?
I do make the case that Al Gore's a hypocrite, only because it's such an easy target. I mean, he wants to save the planet, but he flies around a private jet. He has this information that the world is about to end, but won't give press conferences. It's a funny way to let the world know it's about to end. Don't give press conferences. He gives private speeches that cost $250,000 where he bans the press from. His electricity bill is 10 times the average of an average American. So he is a hypocrite telling people you have to consume less while he's consuming plenty. But you know, that's not my point, and that's not the point of the film, because you know what? I want everyone in America to have Al Gore's electricity bill. I want everyone in America to have a private jet, but I particularly want everyone in Africa to have Al Gore's electricity bill. Can you imagine how wonderful the world would be if everyone in Africa had Al Gore's electricity bill? It would be the end of poverty. And, you know, I'm quite happy to let Al be as hypocritical as he wants, but just let's let Africa get to the standard of living that he has. Let's not hold them down, please, and let's give them the right to fulfill their destiny.
Yeah, that would make quite a difference.
Yeah.
Is there a consensus among scientists about global warming is caused by humans and that we have to do something to reverse it?
No, there's not. You know, there's a consensus among media scientists. But no, we interview people from MIT, from the Arctic Research Center, from really prestigious organizations and groupings, and they're scientists. And interestingly enough, there's no consensus among the anti-consensus scientists, which is the way it should be. They're all arguing about whether it really is warming and whether it'll do any harm or whether it's just a temporary thing. They have no consensus. But that's, you know, it's amazing. Like, you know, 30 years ago they said it was going to be an ice age. Then 20 years ago they said it was going to cool. And, you know, 10 years ago they said the science was settled. So the science basically was turned upside down 20 years ago. And within 10 years ago they said the science was completely a complete consensus. That's not the way science works. You know, it takes some, you know, that's not a way you can run experiments or theories. You know, they need to be proven over time and counterproven and reproven. So no, there's no consensus, you know. But this our film is a chance for ordinary people to see that, you know. And so that's why we wanted to get into ordinary people's homes. Al Gore and the scientific establishment, and Al Gore and the Hollywood establishment don't want you to see this movie, you know. This is the movie they don't want you to see. So we're trying to get it into people's homes, and we're proposing a record-breaking attempt to get this film into people's homes. We're going to bypass the usual Hollywood establishment. And it's going to be a film. You can buy it online in advance. So it's going to be premiered on the 18th of October, and you can buy it online through our website, noteviljustwrong.com. And you'll get the DVD in your pack, but also will come with it. It's a large movie poster to make it a home theater. And then also in the pack is going to be a red carpet, a piece of red carpet. So you can roll out the red carpet to your friends and family, and you're going to be obliged, honor-bound, I suppose, not to press the play button until 8 p.m. Eastern on the 18th of October, so that everyone across the nation can watch the film at the same time. And then afterwards, you can join in a debate coming out of Washington and ask questions about the film and the issues through Twitter and Skype and ways like that and email. And we'll be taking all those questions and answering them, hopefully, as part of this nationwide debate. But this time, the questions are coming from middle America, we hope, the people who are going to be most affected by this global warming alarmism.
So what do you think the motive of the environmentalist and Al Gore in making this case, and some of these scientists who are making the case that this is a human-caused event and that, you know, we need to do these drastic measures? What do you think they're – I know you say they're just wrong and not evil, but
mm-hmm.
I'm going to say something
you never hear environmentalists say, and I'm going to say something you never hear global warming alarmist scientists say. I'm going to say, I don't know. I mean, think about this. I don't know. What is your motivation for constantly having environmental alarmism that really, at the end of the day, its only result is to keep poorer people poorer and to increase poverty in America and the developed world and the developing world? I don't know what their motivation is. In some ways, I don't care what their motivation is. I think they just need to get out of people's lives. So I think maybe that's it. Maybe they're just obsessed. Maybe they just want to control people's lives. Maybe they don't like poor people getting richer, you know, which I think is a great thing. You know, I'm from Europe and a former liberal journalist, as you can hear from my CV, you know, liberal lefty journalists. There are no other kind of journalists in Europe, really. And when I first started working in this, you know, I had this idea of America as this place where there's all these conservatives who are obsessed with your bedroom and what you do in your bedroom. And maybe that's true. Maybe they are. Maybe, you know, there's all these sexually, you know, obsessed Republicans out there, conservatives, who try and introduce laws and all that. And that's what we're told in Europe anyway. But then I got over to America, and whatever about your bedroom, one thing I did find was there's all these liberals there who are obsessed with every other room in your house. They want to control your fridge. They want to control the food in your fridge. They want to control your kitchen, your heating, your light, your thermostat, your garage, what car is in your garage, how you drive your car, how often you drive your car, what, you know, what kind of windows you have in your house, what kind of insulation you have in your attic, you know, how's your cellar, you know, all these things. What lights are in your light bulb, you know, what lamp, you know. And it's like, let's make a deal. Get the Republicans out of the bedroom and get the liberals out of people's, all the other rooms in the houses. You know, let's have a slogan. Get out of my light bulbs. This is America, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, stop telling me what kind of light bulbs I can have. Isn't this a free country?
Now, you touched on the DDT story, talking about Roy Innes, who is, mm-hmm. you know, he's quite a heroic figure in my book as well. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's one thing to have this motive controlling people and industry, but with DDT, when we know it could save millions of lives if it was used to wipe out these mosquitoes that cause malaria, whose interest is it to let this happen? I mean, this goes even way beyond what the global warming motive might be. What do you think about that one?
Well, I think there is a strong population control element in the environmental movement. There's no doubt about it. There's a lot of people who think there's far too many people on this planet, and you know, we need 1 billion people less rather than 6 billion. So definitely, you know, you scratch the surface of an environmentalist and eventually you'll get that line. So, you know, maybe there is a bit of that in it, you know. And they may not admit it to themselves, but I think maybe that is, you know. So, yeah, unfortunately, there's an element of population control, and that generally means controlling the poorer population, controlling the black population, controlling the brown population, not the white environmentalist population, because they have a very serious job, you know.
Right. Well, you also go into some other issues like the banning chlorine in the water, and you know, that's sort of another one that comes right in that same
mm-hmm.
same area. I mean, you
yep.
know, if you do that, that's going to kill another batch of people. But so about trying to build a reliance for our energy on windmills and solar panels.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So give us a little summary of those. We're about running out of time here, and so try to be brief on these couple, please.
Well, it seems to be, I think there's a definite anti-modernity strain to environmentalism. They hate anything new. They hate anything big. They hate any grand designs, any great ideas, you know, at all. I mean, you know, they want us to go back to windmills. Like, windmills are a 15th century solution to a 21st century problem. I say to environmentalists, if you love renewables, the problem with renewables is they don't renew often enough. They couldn't keep a circus running, never mind a city. I say to environmentalists, if you really believe in renewable energy, the next time your parent or your child is ill, you must insist they only go to a hospital that is fueled by renewables. Do you want your child on the operating table and suddenly the sun goes behind the clouds or the wind stops blowing? No, you don't. Well, if it's not good enough for your child, it's not good enough for the poorest people in America, and it's definitely not good enough for the people of the developing world. So stop trying to push on the people of the developing world a method of fueling your community that you wouldn't think is good enough for your own child in hospital. So that, you know, so you'll see all this in the film, Not Evil, Just Wrong, but we really want as many people to buy a DVD. We really want them to have their own house parties, to get back, to bypass Hollywood. This is going to be the cinematic tea parties. All those people out there who held tea parties and are looking for the next thing to do, let's stop cap and tax and cap and trade and global warming tax by having a tea party and getting the message out there that their people are concerned about this issue and it's not going to be pushed through, because this is what they're going, this is how, this global warming tax, this is how they're going to pay for the massive healthcare bill that they're going to run up and the deficit.
Okay. So we need to wrap it up here. So just give me one final, tell people how they can find your website, how they can
mm-hmm.
buy it, and what is unique in the way you're marketing this. You just gave us a little summary of it, but
yeah.
what is the most unique aspect of it? And
well, it's a world record. This is a chance for you to be part of a world record, the biggest ever simultaneous movie premiere. If you buy the DVD through the website, noteviljustwrong.com, and don't play it, and you aren't allowed to play it now until 8 p.m. Eastern, you're not allowed to press the button, then you'll be part of a national movement of people watching at the same time, and then you'll be part of a national movement of people Twittering and Skyping and emailing and phoning in after the screening. So, you're going to get a DVD and a big movie poster and a piece of red carpet so you can invite your friends, your family, and your enemies around to view this very, very important documentary, but a very important issue. And, you know, as they come up the red carpet, take pictures of them, ask them what are they wearing, who are they wearing, you know, dress up for the premiere. And let's send a message to Hollywood and Al Gore and all these elites, you know, that this is a serious issue that's going to affect ordinary people in a very damaging way. And it's going to be a massive stimulus for the Chinese economy.
Thank you. Our guest has been Philip McAleer, thank you for being here, and welcome. Want you to come back and listen to Take Aim again next week for Accuracy in Media. This is Roger Aronoff and Don Irvine signing off.
Great. Thanks, Roger and Don. Bye.
Bye.